HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 156, recorded live Wednesday, April 1st, 2009. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. And by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Aslam Khan about diversity and interaction in agile development teams.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. We're doing an international show today, and we're on the phone right now with Aslam Khan. He's in South Africa, and he's a software architect and a coach. He's got more than 18 years of experience in software. The reason that I wanted Aslam on the show is that he's got a real passion for creating real simple solutions with complex problems. And he's, like me, a pragmatist. And he believes that the only truthful implementation of an architecture is the code that gets executed. I always like talking to pragmatists. And since Aslam's a guy who spends a lot of time empowering teams, I wanted to have him on the show. And we're going to talk about diversity in small teams. And you'll be able to read about more about Aslam on his blog at aslamkhan.net. Thank you, sir, for taking the time. I guess you're up pretty late tonight.
Yes, it's just around 11 p.m., and I've just flown back to Cape Town from Johannesburg, and it's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, thanks. I'm glad that I got you just walking off the plane here. So we wanted to talk about diversity in small teams. You do a lot of coaching of teams, and since you're South African, I assume those teams are fairly diverse.
Yes, I ended up coaching teams accidentally. I've always been studying and writing software with teams. And in South Africa, we get pretty diverse with 11 official languages, of which I only speak two and can't name the other nine, all of them. It gets quite complex. And so the teams that we have that are emerging in South Africa, I'm from various backgrounds. Originally, I think that before the dismantlement of apartheid, we had very, very homogenous teams. We didn't have a large working black population, and the cultures that come with the black population has changed the dynamics of our teams.
And you're living in an environment where it was not long ago when things were dramatically different. In the States, we can say that it's been at least 40 years, maybe 50, depending on when you think things started to turn around. Since things were very bad, things were significantly bad in your lifetime, and even in the lifetime of your teenage kids, I understand.
It has been very, very recent, and sometimes I think we forget how recent it has actually been. And so much has happened since 1994. But leading up to 1994, I mean, I was in university until 1991. So Nelson Mandela was released from prison in 1992. So my university years and high school years was really, really intense, really focused at dismantling apartheid. Mm-hmm. It happened in 1992. And it is such a distinct difference in attitude, in the way we live life in South Africa, pre-1994 and post-1994. The feeling of liberation in 1994 was most probably the most amazing experience I've ever had in my life. And I think to date, it is the single moment in my life where I actually felt that there's a possibility that us as a human species can actually shed differences and live as one. We spent 9 hours standing in a queue in a not-so-great part of Johannesburg in 1994, and it was a single day where there was complete peace, complete harmony amongst every single person that was standing there. It was amazing. And now I think we're facing different challenges and different ways of dealing with some of the issues that we have, and, mm-hmm. and it was completely different from what it was before. 1994 changed everyone's life. It really did.
Well, now people, when people, and I guess since I'm a white man living in America, and I tend to think when I say people, I guess I'm speaking of white folks, think of diversity. Sometimes they think of non-white or they think of mixed groups of people, typically focused around skin color. After 2001, in the States, diversity became a little bit more of an expansive term to mean also people of various religions. And I think that, you know, certainly when people sit down and think about what diversity is, it's everything from, it could be hair color and style. It could be religion. It could be disability. It could be anything. Are people in South Africa still focused on color, or is it more about culture, or is it more about, you know, finances? It doesn't matter what color you are. It matters how much money you have.
It's changing, Scott. I think in South Africa, because we have a previous dispensation where it was law, it was decreed that people will live separately. It was imposed upon you. You can't shed that in 15 years and not think about people in non-racial lines. So I think it's an easy stereotype that you converge on when you describe people and you categorize people. Take it on color boundaries. But I think when you scratch beneath the surface, it is not so much about color. It is a lot more about culture. And in South Africa, in the last 5 years, we have a much greater increase in an emerging black middle class, which is really, really important to South Africa. And so financial position and economic status suddenly introduces more diversity. We're extremely conscious about gender equality. So there's diversity in that. Traditional cultures in South Africa are very patriarchal, mm-hmm. in many parts of the world. And so gender equality is really important. Political affiliation is a really important characteristic that distinguishes people from each other. Which political party you associate with. You can't avoid it in a country like South Africa completely.
Sometimes from the point of view of the ethnocentric West, as the white majority, we here in America tend to look at other countries and say it's just an issue between two groups. We would generalize and say, well, the issue in South Africa is between whites and blacks. You know, the issues in the Asian subcontinent are between Indians and Pakistanis, and it ignores the diversity of the group. Just as you said, there's 11 official languages in South Africa. We still think of it as being a white and black issue, but you, sir, are a South African, and your family's been South African for hundreds of years. And while you are brown, you're not black. Does that change the equation as you go about your business as a developer in South Africa?
That's an interesting question. I have to bring this back into context. During apartheid, you were black. You were not white. That was the distinction. You were not white. You fought the same struggle. You had one so-called enemy in inverted commas. You know, so we fought against the same oppressor, black, okay. African, South African, Indian South African, colored South African. So I must make a distinction. Colored in South Africa is not necessarily how you...
Right. So when you say, when South Africans say colored, they don't mean any disrespect as it was used in the States. They mean mixed, what we call mixed people. So
yes,
my sons are mixed, we would call them in the States, or interracial or biracial.
Yes.
They would be called colored in South Africa without any meanness meant in the statement.
No. None at all. It's children of an interracial marriage. So that is what we mean by colored. So people that were not white, we fought the same struggles. We had the same challenges. And when you worked in that type of environment, you almost invariably reported to a white superior. And that was the context in which you worked. When you come to post-apartheid South Africa, you're struggling to find your own individual identity, because suddenly there is no single person, a single category of people that is oppressing you. So you're actually struggling to find your own identity. So even amongst the African South Africans, we have different cultures. There's Xhosa, there's Zulu, there's Shangaan, Shona, Sotho. So each one of those ethnic groupings are struggling to find their own identity. So as a South African Indian, you struggle to find your own identity as well. Because my identity is not India. It is not that at all. I've never been there. My great-grandfather or grandfather was from there, and it's completely different for me. I have my origins in South Africa. And so working in South Africa, as an Indian, you look for your own identity, and you're fighting a different battle completely.
Right. You're no more attached to India than I am to Scotland of the 1700s.
Exactly. I have no passion for it. I'd love to visit the place.
Yeah, of course.
My mother knows exactly the village where her father came from. She's been there. I have no passion to go there.
Right.
I would like to go there, just out of interest and family history.
The difference, of course, is that I can look at you and make an assumption, make a judgment of where you're from. And since I don't have a kilt and red hair and freckles, people can't look at me and say, your people are from Scotland. So there are all of these initial assumptions when someone shows up on a team. Here in the States, we work on very, very diverse teams. And if I join up with a group of different software developers, I may see two individuals and not be able to tell that one is Indian, one is Pakistani, and maybe they wouldn't be friends because of some particular reason that I can't understand as an American. But I need to think about that as a team manager. But at the same time, I don't want to focus on it because it's not what we're here for. We're here to write software. When you have all of those complexities, how do you get coherence in a team when there's so much underlying history?
I'll touch on that now, but I think that not knowing, I can look at people of Indian origin and I can tell you that this person is most probably Hindu and this person is most probably Tamil and that one is most probably Pakistani, because I'm familiar with the subtleties and differences, the subtle differences between those people. So it might just be an exposure issue.
Sure.
I might just not be familiar with it, you know.
There are some groups that you can't do that with, but I hear what you're saying. I mean, someone might say all Asians look alike, but if they spend time with them, they may find it very easy to tell what country someone comes from. But in all of these things, one makes an assumption, and one cannot be 100% right. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
There was an interesting experiment in the States here recently when someone put out resumes with traditionally white names and then the identical resume with traditionally African-American names. Names that would be, you know, like John Smith on one side and, you know, Levante Jackson on the other side, and see if they would make a difference just based entirely on assumption around naming. And this is a very common thing in, it's happening in Iraq right now. People can tell whether you're Sunni or Shia based on your last name. So.
Absolutely.
This is a worldwide thing. There's being able to look at you and tell by your facial structure, or assume by your facial structure, by your last name, by the way your accent is. All of these things causes initial assumptions to be made, which color, no pun intended, our interactions with individuals.
I 100% agree with you. Is that and those are early stereotypes that we make. Coming back to how we deal with this in a team environment. So I've been through. Last year and the year before that, 2008, 2007, I went through quite a challenging experience working on a project that was 2 years long. And in that project, I had experienced the most extreme conflicts between people that I've ever had in my entire life. To the point where I had people calling each other, you know, leveraging really strong statements to the extent of things like calling someone a white supremacist.
In a work environment, this is happening.
In a work environment, in an open meeting, you know, so really, really strong statements that cut really deep, you know, really close to the bone. We had a huge turnaround of staff. You can just imagine people just breaking down. The spirit of people was just being crushed. And for the first time in South Africa, working with South Africans, there was not a single person outside of South Africa in that team. The first time I felt as if I knew nobody, I never understood a single bit about their culture and about what made them tick in that project. And it bothered me a lot, you know. And it was only towards the end of that project, towards the end of my stay in that project, that I started thinking about what caused all of these things. And some of the things that came through my mind was that we just did not take the time out to understand each other. We just created this tiny little universe, you know, that was isolated from the rest of the world. We came into this project and we felt that, wow, we're going to do this whole thing with the agile way of doing it and create a team value system and everyone will adopt it. And I sat back and thought about it later on and I realized that it is not so easy to create a team value system. Well, how do you create a value system for a team? You know? And I started thinking about how we bootstrapped the team. You know? And we did the typical thing. When we were recruiting for this team, we did the typical thing. We described what we wanted out of an individual. So, you know, the typical stuff, the uber geek, you know, must know this language and must be enthusiastic, you know, self-starter, good leader. And right at the end, we always put down something that says, you know, must be a team player.
Mm-hmm.
So we describe this individual and we're asking them to be part of this team. And so I thought, well, then I said, we should have perhaps described the team identity. I said, we're looking for someone that will fit this team profile. Because when people enter into a new social circle, a team, they have to sacrifice their personal identity for a while to see where they fit into that team. And it's only after a period of time that you start letting your personal characteristics, identity, and self permeates back into the team. And we never let that happen. We just did not let that happen. So
interesting.
We had people with strong political baggage. I'm using the word baggage really poorly, but you know what I mean, is that they have...
Right, they had baggage of some kind, and they brought it with them onto the team on day one.
Yeah, they have a lot of history attached to it, and it defined the way they looked forward in life.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't understand that. I didn't understand that. So we had the result of the fact that I just did not make the time to understand each person individually and what made them tick meant that we had all of these power struggles that were going, these tiny little power struggles that were going on. Mm-hmm. Each person was just trying to find position in this environment. And that was just exploded. It just got magnified over time. And the power struggles became larger and larger and larger. You know, and you get sucked into it. And I started questioning, you know, what does it mean to be in an agile team, and does it make any difference what we're doing as a team if we just don't understand each other as people?
Mm-hmm.
So first and foremost, writing software is an extremely cerebral thing. But at the same time, it is a purely social exercise. Very, very social in its structure. And we just didn't take the time out to spend a few minutes extra each morning just to know each other.
So let me dig into that more, because recently in the States, there's a radio show called Talk of the Nation. It's kind of the American version of World Have Your Say. And one of the discussions was about a study that came out recently that talked about what they're calling colorblind teams and culturally diverse or culturally sensitive teams. Basically, you know, for many years in the States, people have advocated being colorblind. You know, I see you as an individual, judge you on the content of your character, and we basically pretend that we're all the same, and we really try to downplay, not necessarily ignore, but downplay as much as we can issues of color, of religious difference. While the other perspective, which sounds more like what you're describing, is to recognize, to celebrate, to discuss, to be open about cultural differences. One of the things I didn't like about this particular show was that they kept saying that and referring to it in vagaries. But what I want to understand is, if I'm running an Agile team that's very diverse, and diverse doesn't necessarily mean color, it just means that we are all different people. What can we do? What concrete things can I bring to that team? What techniques can I use to change, to frame the discussion?
So I think there's a few things that we can try out. I mean, one of the things I like to try out is to make simple conversations more meaningful. And I go back to the way greetings are done in different cultures. So I come from a Muslim background, right?
Okay.
And the way you greet someone of Muslim background, you say Assalamu alaikum or some derivative of that, or variation
right.
of that.
Which
means
peace be
upon you. That's all it is, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's quite a powerful statement.
It's fundamental. So, I mean, it's a throwaway statement like "How you doing?" But it is meaningful if you dig into it.
Yes. And in Zulu culture, when someone asks you how you are, you know, the literal translation is that the response is not "I am fine." The translation is "I exist."
Right. Nyafila. I am alive still.
I am alive. I exist. And it gets quite colorful. If the person doesn't feel too good or overworked, or say something like, "I'm thin in my pants," you know, it means that, geez, I don't even have time to eat, you know, I'm really working really hard. So in conversation, I would like people to explain a little bit more about how they really mean, because the water cooler passing in the corridor type of, "Hey, Bob, how are you?" You know, "I'm fine, just carry on walking." It's a meaningless engagement. It's completely meaningless.
Right.
You know?
But maybe not to other people, I say.
Yes. So if people just took time out to say a little bit more about, this is how I really feel, you know.
You know, it's interesting. A friend of ours who is from Swaziland is now living in France. He called me a couple of hours ago just to say hello. He was thinking about us. And this always surprises me. Married to my wife for 10 years, she's Zimbabwean, and we have all of these international friends. And this Swazi I haven't talked to in 2 years. "How are you doing?" First sentence. Second sentence: "How are your parents?" He met my parents 8 years ago, 10 years ago at our wedding. But that's just such an African, a South African thing to do. "How are your parents? How are they keeping?" I mean, he remembers brothers and sisters-in-laws and cousins, and how are they? And the "how are you doing" throwaway statement that Americans typically use, you know, "How are you doing?" when I don't really want to know the answer. If the answer is not "fine," then just tell me you're fine and we'll move on. Is almost a ceremonial reverence that happens in African cultures around something as simple as "How are you doing?" He sincerely wants to know how my parents are doing.
You're right. It is not uncommon. And it comes from the fact that the atomic unit in South African society is still the family and not the individual. So when you think about someone and you interact with someone, you interact with them and the entire family. I listened to your show where you did your interview with a few people in South Africa, including your wife, and you spoke a little bit about the elders in her family and the respect that was offered to them and things like that. And the family is still the unit in society and not the individual. And that makes a big difference. That is why we still ask, "Well, how is your family, etc." But it also creates more meaningful understanding of the person. You're actually bringing part of the person's life outside the work environment into the work environment. If you do something like that, and When I think about working in a team, it's like working in a drum. And what is the ceiling? It's the lid of the drum. But when people come into a work environment, they walk into the morning, walk in every morning, you have no idea whether they've had a bad traffic day, a sick child at home, or they're worried about something else. And that could affect their performance. It could affect their behavior. Mm-hmm. And we have no idea about that. And so we have to bridge that in some way. And I think that simple conversations that are meaningful, we do that. It doesn't mean you've got to sit down and 15 minutes or something. It's just a few choice questions that you can ask, and very politely. I think it makes a huge difference.
Hi, it's Scott here from Another Place in Time. I hope you're enjoying the show so far. I apologize for interrupting it, but I wanted to let you know that assembling a podcast like this every week isn't free. Certainly the bandwidth bill crushes us every month, so I want to let you know that this show is sponsored by Telerik. They make the show possible, and they make some pretty cool products as well. For example, if you're trying to build a Web 2.0 Ajaxy application, trying to use the Web 1.0 components, it's kind of difficult. You got to get the next-gen stuff if you want to build the next-gen websites, and that's exactly what the folks at Telerik have got in their new upcoming product, which is codenamed Rad Controls Prometheus. It's a big pack of web controls built entirely on top of the Microsoft ASP.NET Ajax stuff that you already understand. It's going to give you a lot of performance and interactivity on your next project. They mirror the ASP.NET Ajax API, so the development's really straightforward. Client scripts are shared, loading time is pretty fast. You set a couple of properties, you can even bind to web services for a really efficient operation. The new RAD editor for ASP.NET Ajax loads up to 4 times faster than before, and the RAD grid will do thousands of records in milliseconds. But of course, it's better to try these things for yourself, so you can visit telerik.com/ASP.NET Ajax and download a trial. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll get right back to the show. So bringing that back to the concrete, I'm hearing you say that I'm kind of paraphrasing and adding a little color of my own, that we are such logical beings. This is such a hyper-logical, almost dysfunctional thing of the making of software. We are asked as humans to almost, to think like machines. I can see where if I was on a diverse team that had a large number of people that valued family, and I was the hey, how's it going? All right, let's get to work. Individual, that they could start to distrust me, feel that I didn't value the things that they valued. They might not be able to put their finger on it and say, it's because Scott's not asking me how my parents are. They may just have a sense of, I don't think he cares. Is that a fair thing to say?
That's a very real possibility, because you just didn't take the time to understand how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
Very real possibility, and it could manifest beyond just finding out how the person is. The fact is that if you don't take time out to understand the individual's value system, and the value system comes from the value system of their family, of their culture over decades and generations.
Mm-hmm.
So, one of the things in South Africa, in a previous company that I worked at, the director used to call it Ubuntu time. He says this Ubuntu time is driving him crazy, because punctuality was not that important. So if you set a meeting for 10 a.m. and people walked in at 15 minutes past, it was actually okay. And it may be because walking to the meeting in the corridor, in the passage, they met someone and decided to have a conversation and then come in. So it manifests itself in so many different ways. That we have to become aware of these tiny little things that define our own value system.
Now, it's funny that you brought this up, because I posted about this and I called it African time, and there's been a number of different names for this thing. And I posted about this, and I got some very pointed responses on my blog about, who are you to impose your value system and insist that people are on time, or how can you make a judgment about a whole group of people implying that they're not on time? So here I have a South African to prove that these things do exist, that it's not making a value judgment that a person is a bad person to say they are showing up late. They simply value different things. They're not meaning to disrespect me. Like if my wife shows up late for an appointment that we set It's not that mm-hmm. she doesn't value the appointment or the time or my time. It's that something happened that she valued more or differently. And she made that judgment call. And while people in the States might rush away from a chance meeting with a friend in order to make it to a meeting on time, someone that values something differently, like my wife or yourself, perhaps, might let that chance meeting with a friend linger and be 15, 20 minutes late. And if the people at the meeting valued that same thing also, then no one would be insulted or feel at all that it was an inappropriate thing to do.
It can't necessarily be inappropriate. Just following on what you're saying is that in the concept of Ubuntu, I think is extremely powerful for diverse teams because it's about defining. It's a simple philosophy. You mentioned it in your interview with your wife. That is about it says that you are who you are through other people. You know, people are people through other people. So I call it Ubuntu time because people often get delayed, not because they're sitting at their desk, hacking away at some code. It's mm-hmm. because it is important to them to have a 2-minute engagement with someone that they did not see yet in the day before they get to the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And that is important to their values. That was an extremely important thing. Subconsciously, it is. So you can't say that, coming late to the meeting was disrespectful to the meeting and the people at the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that this person had executed a different value that is made up their being. So, when I think about the horrible experience I had with that particular project and all the conflicts that we had, and I think that if we had just dropped back to some of the concepts and philosophies mm-hmm. of Ubuntu, it would have helped. So, we've had leadership in the country that have been trying to reinforce this. So, when Nelson Mandela talks about Ubuntu, he talks about it as simply as when you do something in your community,
mm-hmm.
are you doing it for yourself or are you thinking about how it's going to benefit the next person in your community or your entire community? And I think about it from a team perspective, writing software, the action that you do, have you thought about whether that action is going to benefit the rest of the team?
Mm-hmm.
Often we don't, and that's been my experience, And so let's take a trivial example. Someone commits a broken bolt,
Okay.
Have you thought about it, about how it affects the rest of the team? And if you wrote this line of code, have you thought about how it affects the rest of the team? If you communicate in a particular way, have you thought about how it affects the rest mm-hmm. of the team? And it's just about thinking beyond yourself. That's what it is.
So now some people might say, though, that this is a very kind of Eastern, humanist philosophy that's very different. It's very intangible. This is a philosophy, and one could push back a little bit and say, well, you're telling me to, think about how this line of code affects my coworkers. There's an interesting book by a Harvard sociologist that is making the rounds in the U.S. right now, and it's called The No Asshole Rule. And it is one would dismiss it based entirely on its title. They would say, oh, well, this is a very coarse term. We don't want to be any part of that. But this is an actual, Harvard PhD who's put thought into why he picked such a coarse word. And the whole book could be summed up into that Zulu saying, Ubuntu, Ubuntu, Ubuntu. A person is a person to other people. Don't be an asshole.
Yeah.
And you'll see things like that around the web for years. Do we have to be so intense, so angry, so whatever in everything that we do as developers? Is what we're describing and getting involved and getting along on diverse teams as simple as just try not to be a jerk and think about what you're doing? Is it that easy?
You can break it down to be something as simple as that. But the impact it has is profound, because how do you execute not being a jerk is what is important. Just saying that not being a jerk is a simple statement. Mm. How do you not be a jerk is really important. And it's a really hard thing to do.
Surprisingly hard.
Defining a jerk, you know, it varies between people, you know.
Yeah.
You know, some people might find you completely obnoxious, and others might find you extremely likable. And it's just because the criteria they're using to judge you are completely different.
And that gets into the cultural context of, you know, someone might say, well, I really like how efficient Scott is. He doesn't mince words. He gets right down to business. Well, someone who values something differently might say, wow, he's so cold. He has no interest in our daily life and all he thinks about is work. And that could elicit completely opposite results. How do you reconcile that? Does that mean I need to change? We all need to change our behavior? Or does it just really mean that we all as a team need to temper our behavior and understand that maybe Scott acts that way because he is, here I am talking about myself in the third person. You know, maybe this individual talks this way because that's what they value, and I will not be offended as I ordinarily would be. It's just a matter of relaxing.
I think when we impose individual value systems, when we really impose it on others, we start getting conflict, because people don't tolerate imposition, having the will of someone else imposed upon them. And the way you get harmony is when you do make compromises, and it's the act of compromise that brings about that harmony. And you can't have compromise unless you understand the position that the person is coming from. You understand your own position. You have some reconciliation with that. And I'll take it back to lessons in South Africa again. I spoke about Nelson Mandela and how he describes Ubuntu. And we have Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who describes Ubuntu as a way of respecting someone regardless of what they have done in the past. And here's an amazing individual who chaired the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, which was, I personally believe, was the instrument that prevented us from going into civil war, like the rest of Africa.
And many people still think that the Truth and Reconciliation, the way that they ran the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, is the model for doing such things and needs to be done in other places.
Yes. So we had, it was such a simple concept, but it came back to the same philosophy, that we had closure and we had understanding. People could see who did what wrong to their family in the past. And it's just understanding what happened that people were able to reconcile and move on. And I think it's the same thing when you have conflicts in teams. You just need to actually just sit down and just hear the other person out and try to understand a little bit more about the motives that came from it. And a lot of the times, we live with a blame culture. You know, we always want to blame someone else. A lot of the times, the issue is just that someone made a mistake. It's as simple as that. It was just an honest mistake that is now being blown out of proportion. You know, and we have the blame culture, which detracts from accepting responsibility. And when we go into that blame mode, we don't think back to ourselves and say, oh, what am I doing wrong? It's always someone else that's doing something wrong. And that comes back to the way Desmond Tutu describes Ubuntu, and how it helps with the truth and reconciliation of the society. So it's not different. We see it. I mean, it's not an African thing. Mahatma Gandhi basically said the same thing. So, you got to measure your worth by what you've done to help the next person. It's the same ideas. And I think in software teams, we don't do enough of that. We just sit down and we think about the technical challenges that we're facing. Yet we have to sit down and be social before we can solve problems together.
Hmm. Yeah, it really is a matter of being present and being conscious. And, you know, so much of interaction with people is without formal thought. It's just easier to let the interaction happen. And in those cases, you fall back on all of the things that define you as an individual. Are you going to respond to someone consciously, or are you going to let whatever pops out of your mouth happen? And I'm hearing you say, you know, code consciously, be a member of the team that is present and aware. It doesn't necessarily mean tiptoe around differences with people, but approach them with an open mind and an understanding that they are not necessarily, or almost assuredly, coming at it at the same direction that you are.
Tiptoeing around people becomes the extreme opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're actually walking on these eggshells, and it's being, I mean, it's about political correctness then, which is mm-hmm. just as meaningless. Because you don't have to be offensive to people if you're trying to understand their position. It's the same example as coming late for a meeting, you know. It's a similar thing. When you talk to someone and say, but I didn't understand that, you know, Zulu people or you know, Latinos or whoever it is did things like that. You may be doing, you know, a generalization or stereotyping, but it's not necessarily that you mean it in an offensive way. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to necessarily go to the other extreme of being extremely politically correct just to avoid the issues. You don't want to avoid the issues. You want to deal with the issue. So,
is the problem of political correctness a big thing in South Africa?
Yes, very much so. Everything is a big thing in South Africa.
Well, yeah, I'm just saying that sometimes as a white guy, I feel like maybe it's like maybe white people have the market cornered on yes. being extra careful not to offend anyone.
Yeah. It's such an odd thing, because sometimes I think I don't know whether people are being politically correct, right? Or they're being euphemistic.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, I usually start sentences with, you know, I hope I'm not offending you, but, you know, I mean, there's various levels of offensive, right? I mean, and as a parent of two young black men, there's the hey, let me touch their hair without asking level of offensiveness, which is kind of a lowercase o. But then there's kind of the more like, what are you? What are they? Which is, you know, getting to full on kind of, hey, what are you trying to say? There are ways to approach these differences without making people feel bad about themselves.
Sometimes I think that political correctness should be reserved for bureaucrats and for legalese and getting it right in government communications and formal communications. And when it starts creeping into, you know, social conversation, I wonder whether it's used as a euphemism for, you know, for being scared of offending people. So you tone it down.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we shouldn't tone it down.
That's a very good question. I mean, no one wants to offend someone. I hope, unless you're going out looking for a fight. Yeah. The goal here is not to offend anyone.
I think one of the talk radios here, there's a 9 o'clock show, and the guy is called, you know, Cummings, and he has some really extreme people, you know, people that are extremely tolerant to taking non-politically correct, politically incorrect statements against him, and just dealing with it. And other people can take a very, very soft issue and feel really, really hard done by. And in South Africa, I think we have. To some extent, learned how to deal with what could be considered really offensive to other people. We've learned to deal with it in some ways. It's okay to be very forthright about certain issues. I don't think you can't. I don't think you can be subtle about some things in South Africa.
Well, and in anywhere in the world, I have found, you know, almost always that if one is earnest in their quest for understanding, right? Mm-hmm. If I'm here just to do a better job and just to understand things better so that we can be a team, then no matter how I phrase it, I can usually not offend somebody.
What I found is where it goes wrong, Scott, is when in that discussion that you're having to gain that understanding, mm-hmm. when you have this silent slip over from understanding in general and people start becoming very personal.
Mm-hmm.
So you start judging the person and not judging the situation. So we start having these personal conflicts. And that becomes, starts getting nasty.
Well, I think that's very good advice. The idea that whatever this is, it's not about you personally. Is another important thing. They always say, check your ego at the door.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. And the other day, I watched on one of the TED Talks, there's a UCLA legendary basketball coach, I forget his name.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really great talk. And one of the things he was talking about how he defined success and a few other things and his life philosophies and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that he said that really hit me was that don't try to be better than someone else. All you got to do is learn from someone else.
Don't be better than someone else. Just learn from someone else.
Yes. You don't have to be better than someone else. You just have to learn from someone else. Which made me think that, you know, there is no such thing as a top dog in a team. There isn't someone who is above anyone else. You're just sitting and working with people,
right,
and learning from each other, as opposed to trying to find which strata in the team you actually fit in. And geeks love that. I mean, geeks just love creating these strata and slotting people in.
Yeah.
You know, it comes down to job description. You know, junior developer. You know, senior analyst.
Yeah, yeah.
Goodness sake, you know, testers compared to developers. You're a tester. Oh my goodness, you know.
Yeah, that's definitely not agile. Not, it's kind of against the agile style. And I definitely have felt that I like to. I mean, even though we all, I mean, one person might have 20 years experience, and another person might have a year's experience. I've always kind of liked the two things that I think Jeff Atwood mentioned. That one was, have a really strong opinion, but have it weakly held. You know, fight and know when to stop and say, I guess you are right. Then move on. And then the other one was, we are all amateurs. You know, no matter how much experience you've got, we're really all amateurs. This is a very young discipline, and we're all in this together. You know, Intel actually has a statement in working in teams that they call disagree and commit. And that's really worked well for me in working in diverse teams to say, let's have a fight. Here are the bounds of the fight. You know, here's the cage match. We're going to get in here. It's not personal. Let's fight it out. No yelling, no mm-hmm. personal attacks. And when we're done though, we will all we'll disagree if you didn't like the idea, but we will commit to it. And we don't want to hear, I told you so, or arguments afterwards. And if the entire team in their list of team values can agree that we will disagree and we will commit, though, and put all of our weight behind a particular solution, that works great as a team value in a diverse team.
That's similar to one of the Toyota contradictions. There's this great book called Extreme Toyota that I've been reading, and one of the contradictions in Toyota is that they have a strong sense of structure and order in the company hierarchy,
mm-hmm.
Which everybody honors and respects and goes through the normal channels to get things done. But at the same time, they really encourage people to be extremely vocal, regardless of what position they hold in the company. So it doesn't seem like it can work together, but the fact that they allow people to be extremely vocal means that they do get to hear mm-hmm. about things that concern people, which would ordinarily have been blocked by the strong bureaucratic structures that exist. So it's an interesting way in which they try to manage feedback.
Yeah, I think that that's a very good value. I think Microsoft does that sometimes in the sense of I can speak up. I basically know that you can speak up and know when to shut up are kind of two good values for, two good skills for anyone to develop. I don't think that if you're in a culture that allows you to speak to the president of the company or whoever, or your manager or your manager's manager's manager, if it's an appropriate bit of feedback and communication, then it should be, and it's welcomed, you should use that. And then but at the same time, you should know when to stop. You should say, okay, well, I've said my thing. I'm not going to beat this horse anymore. I have been heard, and then now I'm going to disagree and commit.
I've learned that in the last 6 months from my Scandinavian colleagues. I'm sitting in South Africa, and the rest of my colleagues are in Sweden.
Hmm.
And I learned very quickly that they listen a lot more than I do. They really practice the art of listening.
That is very Scandinavian thing.
Silence at the end of a telephone line for a few seconds, and then you get a response. Or maybe even the next day you get a response. And I constantly tease them, about how polite they are. It comes across as being extremely polite.
Mm-hmm.
I say if they had to go back into war with Denmark, they'll most probably invite them over for a cup of tea instead, and talk about it instead of burning down the Öresund Bridge and that's it, not connected anymore. But it's a really great value to hold, it's exactly the same thing you're saying, that be quiet, listen before you respond. And in some of the teams that I find here in South Africa, is that we're far too eager sometimes to just get our point across, and we interrupt people a lot when they speak.
That's interesting. I think it was my wife that told me this, actually. I should say publicly on my podcast that all good things flow from my wife. She said, are you listening or are you waiting to speak? And when we're arguing, I find that I am sometimes not listening, but rather waiting for my turn to throw words at her. So I think that's a very interesting bit of, I think I've just now understood what she meant by that.
Well, I'm glad I've helped you.
Good. Well, I think this is probably a good place to end our discussion, and I thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule, and I know I've kept you up late in South Africa. I'm sure our listeners do appreciate it.
Well, I feel really privileged to be speaking to you, and I hope that what we've spoken about will help someone else in their teams and help us all to be a little bit of a better species going forward. I really do hope so.
Cool. Well, then I definitely will buy you lunch and a coffee the next time that I go Ekaya and come back to South Africa.
You got to do that. You got to do that. Well, you were in Cape Town in December, and I missed it.
I don't know how that happened. Scandalous.
I wouldn't have made it anyway. I had to come off a very long travel sprint, and
you're working far too hard.
Well, I had a horrible 2007-2008. I was spending weekends in Cape Town with my family and living in Pretoria.
Oh my goodness!
Yep. Yeah. So I think I'm going to actually start a website now called flightmares.com. With all the flight nightmares I've had.
You're racking up the miles, but you're helping people, and I think that we appreciate it. And folks can check out your blog at aslamkhan.net, and I will put all those links up on the show notes. And this has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'll see you again next week.